Welcome to Practical Perspectives on the Management of Patients with Desmoid Tumors, part two of a two-part podcast series. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Professor Bernd Kasper from the University of Heidelberg Mannheim Cancer Center in Mannheim, Germany. And in our first podcast, we did a mini journal club reviewing several key recent presentations and publications. For part two, Professor Kasper discusses several real-world cases presented by Drs. Candice Haddox from the Sarcoma Center of the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute and Dr. Michael Nakazawa and Dr. Elise Haddad from the Department of Sarcoma from the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston. To begin, Dr. Haddox presents a young woman with a very painful mass in the abdominal wall that proved on biopsy to be a desmoid tumor.
This patient is a woman in her 30s who developed a mass in the abdominal wall during pregnancy, and it continued to grow during her pregnancy, and then she came to see us after delivery. She was having significant pain from the tumor, so we opted to start nirogacestat. We started at a lower dose of 50 milligrams twice daily and then up titrated as tolerated. She actually got up to full dose with mild fatigue and manageable diarrhea, and then her pain was significantly improved, so we decided to stop the therapy after 6 months, and she's been on observation since then doing well. So my questions to the expert are, first of all, could you tell us a bit about the association of desmoid tumors during pregnancy? What are the theories and mechanisms there? What are your theories on why desmoid tumors tend to affect females more than males? And also, how do you manage starting nirogacestat? Do you start at full dose or do you tend to taper up as tolerated? I think one of the largest questions in the field is how long to continue therapy and then how to come off of therapy. Is abruptly stopping appropriate? Is tapering appropriate? So many unanswered questions about duration of therapy that we're all really interested in having more data to inform our patients on. What do you see as the most exciting research frontiers for desmoid tumors? What are some agents that you're excited about seeing being explored for this disease?
So I should have told you to keep a pen handy so you could take some notes, but I guess this could be like a cognitive, your memory test, if you can remember.
Yeah.
I jotted them down. Anyhow, so take a shot at some of these questions.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think the first question was something we already touched. That was the relation between females and pregnancy and desmoid tumor growth. I mean, that's something, first of all, you just have to keep in mind that this is a disease in a young patient population, 30 to 35 years, with a two-third female predominance. And yes, there is definitely a correlation between a high incidence of these tumors during or after pregnancy. But there was always this hypothesis or this discussion if there is a correlation between estrogens and desmoid tumor growth, and this could never formally be proven. So, and that is the reason why we do not recommend anti-hormonal therapies anymore. So that's the first question. The second question, I think, was treatment duration, of course. What we usually do is we treat the patients maybe for about 6 to 12 months, and we see a response, a regression of the tumor. And then there is usually a time point when there is no further regression. So the tumor stays stable. And actually, that's the time where we can think of pausing the treatment. And this is usually around maybe between 1 or 1.5 years. And I already explained the example from sorafenib with the SORA-STOP trial. So I think we can think about maybe something between 1 and 2 years. But of course, we have to collect more data on that to really come up with a final answer to this question, how long to treat these patients.
What about this issue of stopping therapy and whether you need to taper it? And also, I was kind of surprised that she started out at a lower dose. You see a lot of people in oncology do that with oral medications, but I'm curious whether you do that as well.
No, actually, we do not do that. We start with a formal approved dose, but then when there are side effects, and I said the side effects usually occur quite rapidly after starting the treatment, within the first days, within the first 1 or 2 weeks. And then, of course, when there are side effects, we maybe start reducing the dose, but we start initially with a normal, regular approved dose. And I think stopping the treatment, when you stop treatment, you can more or less immediately stop treatment. You don't need to fade out or something. That's usually not necessary. And I think the last question my colleague referred to was the question, what is the research field? What are any other interesting compounds or treatment strategies? I mean, I think it's important to mention that there is a second gamma secretase inhibitor, which has already been tested in a large phase 3 trial. Varegacestat is the name, and the trial is called Ringside Trial. Top line data from this trial have already been presented end of last year, just before Christmas, and the results are quite impressive. I mean, the response rate is even higher with 56%, and the progression-free survival, or the reduction of the risk of progression, is 84%, so with a hazard ratio of 0.16, so even better than with nirogacestat. So quite impressive data. Of course, we have not seen the full data set yet. This will be presented during this year, but this is very interesting, and maybe another outlook to another compound, which is a direct beta-catenine inhibitor, which is called FOX001. Data have been presented on that last year at ESMO in Berlin. And this is also a very interesting compound directly targeting the beta-catenine pathway.
So just kind of curious whether you expect varegacestat to be approved. And if it is approved, how we're going to choose between that and Niro? There's so many situations in oncology where you have to do indirect comparison. Seems like there's a lot more follow-up with nirogacestat, but you tell me, how do you think that's going to play out if you have both available?
Yeah, I think difficult to say at that point at the moment. But I mean, at the moment, it looks like that varegacestat has a bit of a higher efficacy with a higher response rate, but not a shorter time to response. Side effects seem to be quite similar for both. So I think, I mean, if we have both available, I think we still have to learn which cases are maybe more suitable for the one or for the other. I think that's actually difficult to say at the moment.
Yeah, I'm thinking back to CLL, you have acalabrutinib, zanubrutinib, and it's tough to make a decision there. Yeah. Maybe that's what's going to happen here. All right, let's go into our next case. This is another younger woman, 39 years old, a patient of Dr. Nakazawa.
This is a 39-year-old lady. She has no other past medical history, who was incidentally found to have a desmoid on a workup of some other medical problem that she was having. And this was located in her rectus abdominis. And the desmoid was quite small. It was palpable, but it was only about 2.5 centimeters. She kept describing that pain as essentially being constant. It seemed to have features of it radiating around. But again, this was very small, but she still needed pain team, you know, nerve blocks essentially to try and control that pain. It was making it very difficult for her to work. Given her symptom burden, we had decided we needed to treat her, but this was still quite small. And given that location and discussing with the patient, she had opted for cryoablation, saying that she didn't want to be on systemic therapy. She read about, you know, some of these medications and side effects, and it was very scary for her. And so we had our, you know, interventional radiology colleagues perform the procedure. Post-procedure, she had some worsening pain locally in that area, but over about 8 weeks, her pain continued to get better and better, eventually to the point where it actually improved beyond what she had before. By 3 months later, the CT showed what was deemed this post-treatment response. You still had the desmoid there. They call this, you know, residual 1.3 centimeter ablation site. And she's since continued off of any sort of medical management. We're just following her up with CT scans, as she says that she's overall asymptomatic. And so, you know, I think this case, it'd be interesting to hear how you counsel your patients going into this procedure about what are you expecting? Is your pain going to get better or worse? How long is it going to take before that pain should get better? And if it doesn't, then we need to really revisit this. And another thing is this scan, there is still a little bit of residual enhancement. And so it's unclear if there's still maybe a desmoid there. We'll just see as we keep going with the scans. But certainly if it grows again and she's symptomatic, can we re-cryoablate this area or not and continue to keep her away from any sort of systemic therapy?
Any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I must admit, I'm not an expert in cryoablation because we are not doing that at our center. But anyway, I think this is a nice example where you have a quite small desmoid tumor. The localization is quite favorable for cryoablation. And I think you can see something which is quite common here. You see, due to the procedure, of course, itself, you see a worsening maybe of pain and symptoms at the very beginning, but then after a couple of time, it's beneficial for the patient. This is, by the way, different, of course, to systemic therapies such as nirogacestat, where you see a symptomatic benefit very rapidly within the first days or weeks. And yes, I think, I mean, if there is a response, and usually there's no need to do anything else, but if there might be a regrowth of the desmoid tumor again, yes, I think you can think of a re-cryoablation. I think there are cases where these cryoablations have been done multiple times. But as I said, I mean, I'm not an expert in cryoablation, but I think it's a nice case where you can demonstrate that cryoablation is also a valuable treatment option in certain situations.
What about this issue, whether or not it's a local therapy like cryo, or systemic therapy like Nyro, where the patient's symptoms get better, but you still see something on imaging? He was bringing up the question of, you know, is it actually active desmoid or maybe some type of scar tissue, et cetera. What do you typically see? Is there like a, you know, do you see situations where there's not really active disease, but you see something on imaging?
Yeah, that's to be honest, that's quite typical. I mean, the desmoid usually doesn't completely disappear, or this may take quite long. But what you see is a kind of residual tumor, but actually you don't have to worry about that. And you don't think about operating that or something like that. Just leave it as it is, and there's no need to do anything else. It's not the classic oncology thinking that we have here. I mean, in general oncology, of course, you want to take the tumor out, whatever it takes. And but this is not necessary here. You just have to treat the symptoms, treat the patient, and if there is residual disease, you can leave it as it is. No problem.
One final question about this case. Interesting, too, in terms of the fact that she had so much pain, she required nerve blocks for this 2.5 centimeter tumor that you wouldn't think was actually in a location that would do cause that much pain. Is this something you typically see? And what's going on? Is this like a nerve invasion?
Yeah, that's sometimes, there is often not a clear correlation between symptoms on the one hand and desmoid tumor growth on the other hand. So obviously, other effects do play a role here, which is not fully understood or not fully described yet. But yes, we sometimes see that even with a small tumor, a high impact in terms of pain or symptoms or problems. And there's not always a clear correlation here.
All right, let's go on to our next case. Now we have another woman, but age 17. Let's hear Dr. Haddix.
This is a patient age 17 who developed a mass in the posterior right proximal thigh. Ultimately, that lesion that she could palpate grew, and she eventually did have workup about 2 years later. A biopsy ultimately showed a desmoid tumor. She was treated with surgery, and 1 year later, the tumor recurred again after the initial resection, and she had another surgery. And then after that, she was monitored. She completed 5 years of surveillance with imaging and then sort of graduated from the clinic. and had no further imaging. She then presented to us 10 years after her initial diagnosis and could again palpate a mass in the area that the desmoid tumor was initially located. There were no related symptoms at that time, just the presence of the mass. And imaging showed actually multifocal desmoid tumors throughout the leg between fascial planes. And she's currently on observation as she's asymptomatic, and we're looking out for indications to start therapy. This isn't common, but we do see it on occasion. And a lot of our patients now are not undergoing surgical resection as part of the management. So hopefully it becomes less common. But so to the expert, have you observed cases where the patient developed multifocal disease after initial surgical resection? And I also want to mention that this patient does not have an underlying germline predisposition to desmoid tumors.
And no history of trauma.
And no history of trauma, correct.
Any thoughts? Have you seen this before?
Yes, that's something actually we definitely see when patients are treated with surgery. And that's also one of the reasons why we are not advocating for surgery anymore here. That has to do with the type of growth of these desmoids. They grow like fingers into the surrounding tissue. And if you cut them out, then there might be a recurrence at multiple localization, at multiple spots around the initial tumor. So this is something we have actually seen multiple times over the last years. And as I said, this is also one of the reasons why we do not advocate for surgery anymore, because of the high recurrence rate and because of the high morbidity these treatments are often associated with.
Any difference in terms of how you manage a patient like this or how they respond to treatment?
I mean, as said before, there is no place for surgery anymore. If there is a progression here, then we would clearly go for systemic therapy. And the primary choice here is, of course, the approved nirogacestat now.
But again, the fact that it's multifocal, you wouldn't necessarily expect to have less of a benefit?
No, actually in the study in DeFi, there were also quite a high percentage of multifocal disease. So that worked also quite well in these cases as well. Yeah.
Really interesting. Okay, let's hear about the last case here, Dr. Haddad. This is a 74-year-old woman. Let's hear about this.
74-year-old female patient. She had past medical history of severe rheumatoid arthritis, which impairs her quality of life, GERD and colitis. I saw her recently and she had this like huge tumor that's actually eroding her scapula, which on the MRI was actually very worrisome for not being a desmoid, but being like a high-grade sarcoma when you look at those images. So it was biopsy proven to be a desmoid. And we started her on nirogacestat. She's 74-year-old. Her pain has improved like within a couple of weeks, which is great for her who already has severe rheumatoid arthritis impairing her quality of life at 74. However, she had mucositis grade 2 in the context of having GERD, colitis. She doesn't weigh a lot, so it did impact her quality of life. And so what we did is we did decrease to 100 milligram BID and added some magic mouthwash, and she's now doing good and happy that the pain improved. I don't have follow-up images yet because we just started the nirogacestat, but clinically she's doing, like within a couple of weeks, she's feeling better on the pain, and then the decrease in dose and the supportive care mouthwash has improved her mucositis. So first question would be, how frequently do you see those tumors eroding bone? Can you see those tumors look like high-grade sarcomas? And then second question is, how quickly do you see clinical improvement with nirogacestat? How quickly on average do you see pain improvement, regardless of size? We know that time to response is around 5 months, but that's RECIST response, right? Shrinkage of disease. But how quickly do you see clinical improvement on average? And then do you have any tips on how to deal with mucositis, as it can definitely impair patients' quality of life? And it's a balance for those tumors of how much benefit you're gaining on the pain versus how much toxicity you're giving patient, and what do you do to deal with this mucositis? How frequently do you see mucositis in patients?
So again, any thoughts? Pretty dramatic presentation there.
Yeah, it is. And yes, I mean, We sometimes see cases like that. I mean, there is a desmoid tumors grow aggressively locally. They do not metastasize, but locally they can grow quite aggressively, and they can also infiltrate the surrounding tissues. So sometimes we also see an infiltration of the bones, which is not so common, but yes, we sometimes see that. The second question was about the benefit of the treatment or the symptomatic response. And I think we discussed that before, that the gamma secretase inhibitor leads to a quite rapid symptom improvement within the first days or weeks. And this is something we can really see long before the radiological response, which, as Elise already elucidated, is much later, with a median of 5.6 months. Mucositis or stomatitis is something which we saw in the DeFi trial in, I think, up to 30% of the patients. So this is quite a common side effect. And to be honest, we can only treat this with conventional procedures, mouthwash, painkillers, and of course we can dose reduce. And I mean, that's obviously something my colleague also did, and usually that works very well.
What about the size? It's a very large tumor, and benefits from nirogacestat. Do you see less benefit in a huge tumor like this?
No, I think the average size of the tumor in the trial was, of course, around something between 5 and 10 centimeters or something like that. But we actually see response in small and in also bigger tumors that doesn't have a real impact.
Any other key issues we haven't discussed today?
Maybe another question is rechallenge of therapy. Is it possible to rechallenge with the same drug if we have treated the patients with this drug before? I believe it's possible, but of course, we do not have strong data for that. This is maybe something we have not covered yet. Yeah, but I think we covered the most important points.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really important question in patients who are getting stopped and then later on they progress. But also, maybe you might have some thoughts theoretically of using one of the gamma secretase inhibitors after the other. So a patient who gets niro and then progresses, any chance that they might respond to varegacestat?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that actually the number of patients who do not respond to nirogacestat is quite low. In the study, to be honest, I think there was only one patient showing progressive disease. The response rate was 41%, and there were another 50% with stable diseases, so only one progression. But yes, I mean, if you have the situation where the patient does not respond to the first gamma secretase inhibitor, you can, of course, try the second one, and that might also work. Of course, we do not really have much experience on that yet, but this is definitely something we will learn more about in the next couple of years.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Professor Casper and our case presenters, and thank you for tuning in. Conflict of interest statements for the faculty can be found in the program notes, and please note that the use of agents and treatments that are not approved may have been discussed in the program, so check out the package inserts for more. This is Dr. Neil Love for Practical Perspectives on the Management of Desmoid Tumors.